Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Today on Inside Austin, from Austin Literacy First, is Dr. Claire Hagen Alvarado, Executive Director. How are you today?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me.
Hi. I very much appreciate you joining us. You are joining us for, a couple of reasons. One, literacy is obviously a very important thing to talk about, but next week is Children's Book Week. And so I wanted to touch on that before we got to anything else. What exactly is Children's Book Week?
Yeah, I think it's, a national way to engage children and families in reading, essentially. And I know we have different events around Austin to support that, as well as national efforts. And certainly our organization, which focuses very intensively on early reading skills, also incorporates the larger world of reading and leading children to a passion for reading, as well as having all the skills they need to take off with their reading and educational and life trajectories. And it is nationwide. And so you'll probably see different organizations hyping lots of different areas, whether it's an organization like ours that does focus on high dosage tutoring, or maybe an organization like American Library Association and working with getting kids access to books, or interest in different authors and hyping various author awards and diversity around that. So I think it's a pretty broad way to celebrate and bring attention to children's literacy that provides this umbrella for all the beauty of learning to read and becoming a great reader.
Now, I'm sure the people that are out there that are listening are thinking to themselves, I bet you at some point while you were talking about children learning to read and things like that, I guarantee you a book from your youth popped into your head. It's impossible that it didn't. I know it did to me. A few different books popped into my head as you were speaking of that. So the importance of reading, which we'll get to in a second, not just from a development standpoint and a child's health standpoint, but they're, just from a societal standpoint, how important learning to read really is. Can you tell us some ways that you or your organization, Austin Literacy First, is helping with Children's Book Week?
Yeah, the main way we engage with Children's Book Week is to bring that into our work with the children themselves. And we work in 5 different school districts across Central Texas, and we provide a one-on-one reading intervention that's 30 minutes every day in Spanish or in English. And in tandem with that, we're always looking for ways to engage kids in reading. So offering books at the tail end of our intervention and giving those out is something we'll look to do. We also recently brought in an author to support our new AmeriCorps members who have been in the classroom now and with their students for just over a month. And so giving the tutors the book from the author to hand out in Spanish or English is always a great way that we can support and hype up Children's Book Week.
Being able to see that author and, have the intimate knowledge that author has to be able to speak to a child about that book, that's a great way to lock a child into reading and getting into the imaginary part of reading.
Absolutely, yes. And schools are constantly looking to do that. I know that across Austin school libraries, they're often bringing in children's book authors and bringing the writing side and the part behind the polished product to life, and then engaging kids also in their own writing and their ability to tell their stories or imagine what stories they might put down on paper.
When it comes to, you know, children who are growing up to be authors, is I would imagine that engaging with people who are writing at a young age probably has a lot to do with it. I have a couple of author friends, and that makes me want to ask them that question. Is that, you know, was it a teacher? Was it a, you know, because it that's not an easy path to go down to be a writer. That is, you know, a lot of hard work for little reward, even if you are end up on the New York bestseller list. So it's in. You know, obviously people who are authors are big readers, but I would imagine that that interaction where you do meet an author and get the intimate knowledge and get the discussion on a lengthy level with that author, that probably does spark kids to not just want to read, but also to write.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we, you know, we work primarily with kindergarten, first and second graders. And we do, like I said, the reading intervention part, but certainly also partner with schools, on comprehensive literacy services. And so that includes a lot of writing and recognizing that even our youngest children come to school with tons of stories to tell. And that early engagement with like building up your almost your writing fluency and no inhibitions around what you put down on paper can absolutely inspire future writers. I think authors come to that profession in so many different ways. Sometimes it's even that they weren't engaged with reading or writing at a young age, but then something sparked that interest, whether it was a book or maybe their own child. And that's when they take off with honing their craft. So ideally, I think that comes from early engagement with literacy, whether it's at home or at school, but knowing that our kids come with lots of language and lots of stories and they're ready to go. And then what happens when they're not engaged as much or when they're struggling with their reading, then you see the after effects of that struggle in future grades. So that's one reason we really, really pride ourselves and have focused so intensely on the early grades. We often see different intervention type programs happening or the need, the call from our district representatives or school representatives happens third grade and up after we already see these signs of struggle. And we instead try to put that attention on kindergarten, even pre-K and early literacy skills so that we can counter any effects of challenges with reading and difficulties with reading and make sure that kids have all the skills they need to take off on their reading trajectories or writing trajectories, knowing that it's all intermingled with literacy.
Along those lines, I would actually like to talk to you about how important the, you know, learning to read and the learning to read well are for a child's, not just ability to function in school and as an adult and things like that, but also their, you know, it has ties to their actual health. It is amazing how something like that can be so interwoven, and when somebody doesn't know how to do it, it affects them in ways that, you know, most people probably wouldn't think about. And, you know, the ability to read, and, you know, obviously a lot of people take it for granted, but, you know, now, obviously deficits aside, I'm not talking about people who have learning disabilities and stuff like that. I'm talking about the poor children that have fallen through the cracks and have become adults who, you know, are functionally illiterate at best. You know, talk about how important it is and the actual effects it has on somebody.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are short and long-term effects of reading well. You know, in those early grades, we can see that when kids are reading well by end of second grade or even end of first grade, certainly by third grade, they're able to engage with their peers that maybe didn't have signs of difficulty. They're able to engage with content and not spend so much time and energy getting bogged down and understanding what they're reading, but instead go on to engage more deeply with the subject matter. And from there, you know, we see higher graduation rates when kids do have success in reading at an early age. There's actually more brain activity and that happens when you have that fluency and proficiency in reading. It can, like you said, there are health effects. It can even improve your sleep if you have that regular routine and proficiency with reading and a way to de-stress and calm your anxiety, which is kind of an interesting effect. And then I think motivation is one of the biggest things we see. We see that even when we intervene with third graders, for example, they've experienced several years of maybe struggling or not being able to engage the way they would otherwise with their classmates or with their subject area content. And so they feel that. They feel that acutely. So it ties into self-esteem and your motivation and positivity toward learning or towards school. So I think, then you go down paths of lots of identity as a student and as a successful student and what can come from that. So it's pretty all-encompassing and arguably the most important skill and the most important way I can think of spending my time and the time of that our volunteers put forth to support kids in learning how to read early so that they don't feel these, so that they can benefit from the positive effects of reading and not those negative trajectories that can happen and kind of build on each other over time.
As an adult, the inability to read leads to, not earning the same amount of wages as somebody who can, which leads to poor health. One of the biggest ties to poor health is poverty. And, a lack of education, unfortunately, is very intimately tied in with poverty, whether we care to address it or not. But it is, that is a fact. And so the ways that it can impact your life are not something beyond just, oh, that person, they can't read. And as you said, self-esteem, that's one of those shames in this world still to this day. Whereas if somebody can't read, they're horrified if that gets out. Nobody can know that. They go to great lengths to hide it. And, whether it is a learning disability or not, whether it is just a lack of opportunity due to a lack of quality education, or they're dyslexic and have never been diagnosed or have never been properly treated for it. It's a skill set that so many people take for granted. But yet at the same time, though, a huge population of the entire world can't read.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
We are joined by Dr. Claire Hagen Alvarado. She is the executive director of Austin Literacy First, which, if you would like to volunteer or donate or just check out their program, go to literacyfirst.org. We were talking about the health effects of not being able to read for somebody who, and the impact on their life, somebody who can't read due to just a lack of proper education. Can we talk a little about the people who do have the learning deficits, who are struggling no matter what they do, no matter what the education they're getting, if it's not the proper education as far as recognizing that they are dyslexic or they do have some sort of deficiency in that area? How hard is that? Well, obviously that's a very general and hard question to answer, but how hard is that to struggle with as an adult, not just as a kid?
Oh, yeah, I think that can be can take over lots of areas of your life from a very, very young age. And so, unfortunately, there are these compounding effects that really we could change if we have some way to diagnose or even to do a screening early on for young children. And then as kids get older, too, and probably even definitely for adults, seeing exactly where they are in reading and having that formal type of assessment and way to intervene can really change and help someone's, greater effects in their life. What we see for our children in kinder, first and second grade is, for example, we're able to do that beginning of year reading, developmental reading assessment to see exactly where they're at with their foundational reading skills. And then we build a really responsive intervention based on that data. And we also progress monitor every week. And so based on that, we have a lot of information that we can share with teachers and the rest of the school staff if they do determine that a student needs to have more intervention or more possibly more testing to determine if dyslexia services are needed or if other special education services might be needed. And so, again, I'll emphasize the benefits and importance of that early understanding of what is needed, because like you said, it doesn't go away as children get older and then move into adulthood, and certainly their careers and life trajectories can be really severely impacted by their fluency and proficiency with reading.
Well, because it's not just an issue of not having learned properly to read, that it is something that you have to deal with forever. It isn't just, you know, you are a little bit behind on your learning to read in the second grade and you get caught up by the fourth grade or something like that. You know, this is something that you are constantly dealing with.
You know, for the most part, with some really intensive and careful and responsive instruction that does attune to a variety of foundational literacy skills, most people can learn to read. So you talk about the inability to learn to read. It's generally that they might need, they might need a different type of instruction. They might need it to be more systematic or explicit or spiral different skills so that they have a review. But most people are completely capable of learning that skill. And so, unfortunately, like you mentioned earlier, it's oftentimes a lack of opportunity or, lots of different factors with interrupted schooling right now, for sure, the past few years that have created a pretty profound effect on our readers.
I actually wanted to get to that, but I real quick, I want to say that was just poor phrasing on my part, calling it the inability to read. I guess I meant a problematic, I'm not even sure of the phrasing. I'm just an idiot DJ, so I'm not even sure how to say it myself. So it's one of those things where, you know, I meant nothing by it, more along the lines that, you know, somebody who is dyslexic, it's not that they have the inability to learn to read. It's that their inability, their learning to read is hampered.
Yeah, no, but I think the way you're talking about it makes sense. And it's just that we were going through a lot of different changes in the way we teach reading, based on the science of teaching reading and making sure that our teachers across the state of Texas, for sure, and definitely across the country, have a strong understanding of the science and research behind teaching reading and then implementing that theory as well, and having cohesive instructional systems within our schools. And so it hasn't always been very effective, unfortunately, and has had pretty traumatic results.
It's because for the longest time, we had the idea that everybody learned the same way. And we had the idea that, unfortunately, a lot of schools, particularly I was in high school in the 90s, a lot of schools, they taught you to pass standardized tests. And this isn't an indictment on any particular school system or anything like that. I understand that's where funding comes from and all of that other stuff. I'm just saying that, you know, it's a choice in what you get taught. And sometimes when you get taught things that are necessary to pass a test, but aren't necessarily life skills, you know, some other things do end up falling through the cracks.
Yeah. Thinking about how we test and we have high stakes testing and reading starting in third grade. And unfortunately we oftentimes wait until third grade to know or to do something about a student who is struggling in reading. And that's pretty late when we can easily know where students are when they're 5 and 6 years old and can make sure they have more in-depth instruction at their fingertips ready to go so they can take off with their reading.
Well, you had said a second ago about how much COVID and the shutdown and all of that stuff has impacted the children's inability to get a proper education and how it has literally set kids back years. And I would imagine that one of the first, canary in the coal mines was children's learning ability as far as reading is concerned.
We've seen last year and then also this year that whereas pre-pandemic, about half of the students in the schools where we serve, which are under-resourced schools, half of the students were qualifying for our reading intervention. And last year, so beginning of 2021, that number was up to 70% of students were qualifying. And the really striking thing to me is that, again, this year, in the beginning of or fall of 2022, 70% of students qualified again. And so where they were mostly, kids were mostly in school last year, but there were certainly disruptions and lots of hardships on the part of teachers and shortages, just kind of getting through the year, and then also coming out of the previous year and a half that have had very profound effects. So I think we're just starting to understand. We see kids also coming in at lower levels. So in second grade, for example, we would reasonably expect a second grader to come in reading 50 words a minute and to really understand what they're reading. And a quarter of the students in the schools we serve in second grade were reading maybe one word in a minute. I mean, that's it. And then another quarter were reading just a few words. And so that's a pretty striking difference. They're performing, at least the students we're working with and that we've seen, are more like a kindergarten level than second grade. And you can understand why. I mean, a second grader was in pre-K, the end of pre-K, when the shutdown happened. Kindergarten might have been remote or whatever their family chose. And then last year, first grade was also interrupted. And so they're in a different moment, for sure.
Yeah, they're 3 years behind just being a basic student. You know, the expectations of whatever the habits of being in school are lost. And, you know, that I was going to ask that, is that where you're seeing a big difference as far as kids are concerned, is in that like third grade, second grade area where they are just going to school full time for the first time, and they should have done that 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly where we have the data. And, you know, in our 33 schools, and the students we've assessed up to about 6,000 students, that's what we're seeing. Now, I do have calls coming in from different principals and district representatives asking for support with upper grades as well. And I think that these similar effects are seen in upper grades, but perhaps not as acutely, or they might just not have the developmental reading data to show that. But I've certainly, there was disruption and learning lost, you could say, for those upper grades as well. But I think for our students who had not had as much experience in school, or maybe haven't built that foundation of reading, they're needing that right now more intensely than ever before, for sure.
Well, I also think that parents probably realized how, I don't want to say this without sounding sort of insulting, but it's going to come across that way, where parents all of a sudden realized that they didn't have the time. And I don't mean that in a lack of wanting to, but they didn't have the time to properly teach their kids if the schools weren't capable of doing it in that moment. And I think that, you know, you've got two parents in your house, if you're lucky, and they're both working two full-time jobs and not a piece, but, you know, they're gone 40, 50 hours a week, each of them. There's, you know, there are some inequities as far as that is concerned just from the get-go. But when you are behind as far as your schoolwork is concerned and school socialization is concerned, it's you know, it's a snowball effect. I can't imagine how hard this is going to be in the next few years as these kids do progress and some are falling through the cracks and some are revealing how far they have lagged behind and things like that. You know, it's kind of sad to think that this is a universal problem in our country right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were, you know, absolutely heroic effects by schools. I had two little ones at home during that time, and seeing the instruction that was going on virtually, I think helped. And perhaps for older kids who could also engage more through that platform and that media, they weren't, you know, they learned maybe other skill sets. Everybody learned other skill sets. But for our younger kiddos, I know for my kindergartner at the time, he was not interested in learning through a computer whatsoever. And I was you're right, my husband and I were working full time, and I teach reading. And I, beyond reading books with him and doing a little bit of instruction. It was hard to find that time and hard to get him to engage with me around more formal instruction as well. So I think parents who don't maybe have the skill set of how to teach reading also were really keenly interested and have probably come a long way, and also listening in to their child's instruction virtually might have given them some knowledge and skills. But I think we're left with that question of how we support parents more, because whereas our tutors are in classrooms or in schools and tutoring one-on-one every day, you know, really concentrated, high-impact, high-dosage tutoring, families also can contribute, of course, to their child's literacy development, even if it's not that really, really formal level. But certainly things that are as basic as reading with their kids every day and having different exposure to reading does go a long way. And there's some more targeted skill work that they could potentially add on.
Well, I wanted to ask a quick question. You were talking about your own children's experience and things like that. And I would imagine when it comes to not just you, but every parent out there, you have to battle your child's innate reflex to go the path of least resistance. And the path of least resistance isn't, you know, sitting there learning to read. It is zoning out and playing on a tablet or watching cartoons or something like that. And so being able to engage them to get them to want to do it is probably the hardest thing that you do both professionally and as a parent. I'm not a parent, so yeah. I have to throw that out there. I'm not going to even pretend like I know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I think that's certainly true. And I don't think it's a battle that sometimes is the right battle with your child, at least for my children. We really relish the opportunity to read every night, and we read a lot. But to try to, I tried to do a more formal phonics lesson with my kindergartner at the time, you know, a series of them. And he was going to resist in any way possible to not follow and respond and interact with me in that way. And in a way, it's far more beneficial for someone who's not the parent or primary caregiver to provide that formal instruction, and can be really helpful to have someone else doing that. And what we find is that our greatest benefit is when kids are in school and we can teach them in the school setting and do the high impact tutoring right there as part of their full package of their day. Anytime we try to do our tutoring model after school or in the summer, we're seeing really different results. Kids are not responding the same way and not progressing the same way. So we've chosen to really concentrate our instruction during the school day and partner with schools for that reason, because we want to have the biggest impact possible. And for families to choose maybe to drag their kid through a formal lesson that they may not know how to teach very well, or they may feel boring to the child, that probably isn't going to do a whole lot. It could, depending on the student, but there might be better benefits for others to jump in and help as well, and to really have that really good relationship and understanding with your school and your teachers of where your child's at and how you might specifically support and enhance the instruction that they're receiving during the school day.
Well, you push with any kid hard on something that they don't want to do, and you're going to make it infinitely harder on yourself to ever get them to do it. It's like trying to convince a child to eat their broccoli. You know, no matter what story or airplane noises you make up, they know it's broccoli and they're not interested. So it's, you know, getting them to be engaged, even if that is through an outside source, which I want to talk about your volunteers here in a second, but even to get them engaged from an outside source is, you know, that's job well done by a parent. That's understanding, you know, what they're capable of and what they're capable of giving to their kids and filling in what they're not capable of.
Yes, absolutely.
I wanted to talk about your volunteers here really quick, and that's because we're running short on time. And that's walk us through what it's like to be a volunteer. And you know, I guess, what is the average, let's start with something here, and that's that, when is the average time you should expect a kid to learn to read, and when is the average time it's best to start an intervention knowing that there's something wrong, and then walk us through what your volunteers do.
Sure, yeah. So kids are really, even before they're born, are learning language and hearing sounds and starting those building blocks that brings them into reading. And then, however, it's not intuitive. And so some really formal instruction does have to happen for kids to learn how to read. So we've found, definitely we could work with pre-K programs and start there. But kindergarten has been an excellent moment for us as a program to see where kids are entering and then what they might need from there. And so our volunteers and our tutors, we have two different models. One is an AmeriCorps program where someone of any age, they could be 17 or they could be 100, can come and volunteer with us, and they receive 50 hours of training starting September 1st. And then they're in schools, in an assigned school, every day for the remainder of that school year, so until the end of May. And through AmeriCorps, you're receiving different benefits like the Education Award and accruing different hours, and there's different workforce development opportunities. There's an opportunity to become a teacher for those who are interested, and we do have about up to 20% of our alumni who go that route. And then they're basically, like I said, in schools every day from about, there's a couple different schedule options, but 7:30 to 2:30, and they just build these amazing relationships with students and with their colleagues at the school. And you can imagine, working one-on-one with a child is very different from having a full classroom or even a small group of kids that you're working with. So one-on-one can be just this amazing opportunity to understand where a kid's at, to really learn from them and they learn from you, and bring them forward with some careful data systems and a really careful intervention model that we found to be very effective.
Now, if somebody wanted to be a volunteer, if one of those people out there listening is 17 to 100 years old and did want to volunteer with you guys at Austin Literacy First, literacyfirst.org is their website, and there's places to donate, but also if you want to volunteer, there is a sign-up option there also.
Yeah, I think just go to our website, literacyfirst.org. We've got our socials there, opportunities to donate or connect with us in our newsletter or become a tutor, and we'd love to hear from you. There's a Become a Tutor section, and you can learn more and hear some stories and videos of our tutors who we just think are incredible. We always are looking for more tutors who are bilingual, because a unique element of our program is that we tutor in Spanish and in English. We're probably the only program that does that in the country. We really pride ourselves on being able to support students in foundational languages and to build biliteracy and bilingualism in our young children. Kids actually learn and acquire English easier and faster when they have a really strong foundation in their primary language. And so it's more beneficial to continue that primary language and add other languages alongside. And also we find that most of our multilingual students are simultaneous bilinguals. So they very likely were born in the U.S. and they have been around English and Spanish or other languages their whole lives. And so we want to be able to grow all of those languages, and we see awesome brain effects from that. And they can certainly learn to read across languages, and many of the skills of literacy transfer across languages. So if we can teach in Spanish and then students add in English, it's a really effective model that most schools across Texas are adopting, and that TEA is also emphasizing as like two-way dual language and one-way dual language being the most effective way to teach.
It makes sense when you explain it like that, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We are talking to Dr. Claire Hagen-Alvarado, the executive director at Austin Literacy First. It is Children's Book Week next week. I very much appreciate you coming on and giving us some of your wisdom.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.